45 by a coronary. That dark enemy which had either maimed or killed a whole generation of 50-year-old male Ashkenazi Jews raised on sour cream and fat-flaked brisket. His dad hated his new job, but it kept the family solvent. Not only did it pay well, but its long hours kept Dad away from Laurel and Pimlico, the local racetracks. On Julius's first day of school at Roosevelt High in September 1955, he made a momentous decision. He would redo himself. He was unknown in Washington, a free soul unencumbered by the past. His past 3 years at PS1126, his Bronx Junior High School, were nothing to be proud of. Gambling had been so much more interesting than other school activities that he spent every afternoon at the bowling alley lining up challenge games, betting on himself or on his partner, Marty Geller, he of the great left-handed hook. He also ran a small bookie operation, where he offered 10-to-1 odds to anyone picking any 3 baseball players to get 6 hits among them on any given day. No matter who the Pigeons picked, Mantle, Kaline, Aaron, Vernon, or Stan the Man Musial, they rarely won, at best once in 20 to 30 bets. Julius ran with like-minded punks, developed the aura of a tough street fighter in order to intimidate would-be welchers, dumbed himself down in class to remain cool, and cut many a school afternoon to watch Mantle patrol the Yankee Stadium center field. Everything changed the day he and his parents were called into the principal's office and confronted with his bookie ledger book, for which he had been frantically searching the previous couple of days. Though punishment was meted out, no evenings out for the remaining 2 months of the school year, no bowling alley, no trips to Yankee Stadium, no after-school sports, no allowance. Julius could see his father's heart wasn't in it. He was entirely intrigued by the details of Julius's 3-player 6-hit caper. Still, Julius had admired the principal, and falling from his grace was such a wake-up call that he attempted to reclaim himself. But it was too little, too late. The best he could do was to move his grades up to low B's. It wasn't possible to form new friendships. He was roll-locked, and no one could relate to the new boy Julius had decided to become. As a consequence of this episode, the latter-day Julius had an exquisite sensitivity to the phenomenon of roll-lock. How often had he seen group therapy patients change dramatically, but continue to be perceived as the same person by the other group members? Happens also in families. Many of his improved patients had a hell of a time when visiting their parents. They had to guard against being sucked back into their old family role, and had to expend considerable energy persuading parents and siblings that they were indeed changed. Julius's great experiment with reinvention commenced with his family's move. On that first day of school in Washington, D.C., a balmy Indian summer September day, Julius crunched through the fallen sycamore leaves and strode into the front door of Roosevelt High, searching for a master strategy to make himself over. Noticing the broadsides posted outside the auditorium advertising the candidates for class president, Julius had an inspired thought, and even before he learned the location of the boys' room, he had posted his name for the election. The election bid was a long shot, beyond long shot. Longer odds than betting on the tight-fisted Clark Griffith's inept Washington senators to climb out of last place. He knew nothing about Roosevelt High, and had yet to meet a single classmate. Would the old Julius from the Bronx have run for office? Not in 1,000 years, but that was the point. Precisely for this reason, the new Julius took the plunge. What was the worst that could happen? His name would be out there, and all would recognize Julius Hertzfeld as a force, a potential leader, a boy to be reckoned with. What's more, he loved the action. Of course, his opponents would dismiss him as a bad joke, a gnat, an unknown know-nothing. Expecting such criticism, Julius readied himself and prepared a riff about the ability of a newcomer to see fault lines invisible to those living too close to the corruption. He had the gift of gab, honed by long hours in the bowling alley of wheedling and cajoling suckers into match games. The new Julius had nothing to lose, and fearlessly strolled up to clusters of students to announce, "Hi, I'm Julius, the new kid on the block, and I hope you'll support me in election for class president. I don't know crap about school politics, but, you know, sometimes a fresh look is the best look. Besides, I'm absolutely independent. Don't belong to any cliques because I don't know anybody." As things turned out, not only did Julius recreate himself, but he damn near won the election. With a football team that had lost 18 straight games and a basketball team almost as hapless, Roosevelt High was demoralized. The other two candidates were vulnerable. Catherine Schumann, the brainy daughter of the diminutive long-faced minister who led the prayer before each school assembly, was prissy and unpopular. And Richard Heisman, the handsome, red-haired, red-necked football halfback, had a great many enemies. Julius rode the crest of a robust protest vote. In addition to his great surprise, he immediately was embraced vigorously by virtually all the Jewish students, about 30% of the student body, who had heretofore kept a low, apolitical profile. They loved him, the love of the timid, hesitant, make-no-waves Mason-Dixon Yid for the gutsy, brash New York Jew. That election was the turning point of Julius's life. So much reinforcement did he receive for his brazenness that he rebuilt his whole identity on the foundation of raw chutzpah. The three Jewish high school fraternities vied for him. He was perceived as having both guts and that ever-so-elusive holy grail of adolescence, personality. Soon he was surrounded by kids at lunch in the cafeteria and was often spotted walking hand in hand after school with the lovely Miriam K., the editor of the school newspaper and the one student smart enough to challenge Catherine Schumann for valedictorian. He and Miriam were soon inseparable. She introduced him to art and aesthetic sensibility. He was never able to make her appreciate the high drama of bowling or baseball. Yes, chutzpah had taken him a long way. He cultivated it, took great pride in it, and, in later life, beamed when he heard himself referred to as an original, a maverick, the therapist who had the guts to take on the cases that had defeated others. But chutzpah had its dark side. Grandiosity. More than once, Julius had erred by attempting to do more than could be done, by asking patients to make more change than was constitutionally possible for them, by putting patients through a long and ultimately unrewarding course of therapy. So was it compassion or sheer clinical tenacity that led Julius to think that he could yet reclaim Philip? Or was it grandiose chutzpah? He truly did not know. As he led Philip to the group therapy room, Julius took a long look at his reluctant patient. With his straight light brown hair combed straight back without a part, his skin stretched tight across his high cheekbones, his eyes wary, his step heavy, Philip looked as though he were being led to his execution. Julius felt a wave of compassion, and in his softest, most comforting voice, offered solace. "You know, Philip, therapy groups are infinitely complex, but they possess one absolutely predictable feature." If Julius expected the natural curious inquiry about the one absolutely predictable feature, he gave no sign of disappointment at Philip's silence. Instead, he merely continued speaking as though Philip had expressed appropriate curiosity. "And that feature is the first meeting of a therapy group is invariably less uncomfortable and more engaging than the new member expects. I have no discomfort, Julius. Well, then, simply file what I said, just in case you run across some. Philip stopped in the hallway at the door to the office in which they had met a few days before, but Julius touched his elbow and guided him down the hall to the next door, which opened into a room lined on three sides with ceiling-to-floor bookshelves. Three windows of wood-lined panes on the fourth wall looked out into a Japanese garden graced by several dwarf five-needle pines, two clusters of tiny boulders, and a narrow 8-foot-long pond in which golden carp glided. The furniture in the room was simple and functional, consisting only of a small table next to the door, 7 comfortable rattan chairs arranged in a circle, and 2 others stored in corners. Here we are. This is my library and group room. While we're waiting for the other members, let me give you the nuts and bolts housekeeping drill. On Mondays, I unlock the front door about 10 minutes before the time of the group, and the members just enter on their own into this room. When I come in at 4:30, we start pretty promptly, and we end at 6. To ease my billing and bookkeeping task, everyone pays at the end of each session. Just leave a check on the table by the door. Questions? Philip shook his head no and looked around the room, inhaling deeply. He walked directly to the shelves, put his nose closely to the rows of leather-bound volumes, and inhaled again, evincing great pleasure. He remained standing and industriously began perusing book titles. In the next few minutes, 5 group members filed in, each glancing at Philip's back before taking seats. Despite the bustle of their entrance, Philip did not turn his head or in any way interrupt his task of examining Julius's library. Over his 35 years of leading groups, Julius had seen a lot of folks enter therapy groups. The pattern was predictable. The new member enters, heavy with apprehension, behaving in a deferential manner to the other members, who welcome the neophyte and introduce themselves. Occasionally, a newly formed group, which mistakenly believes that benefits are directly proportional to the amount of attention each receives from the therapist, may resent newcomers. But established groups welcome them. They appreciate that a full roster adds to, rather than detracts from, the effectiveness of the therapy. Once in a while, newcomers jump right into the discussion, but generally they are silent for much of the first meeting as they try to figure out the rules and wait for someone else to invite them to participate. But a new member so indifferent that he turns his back and ignores the others in the group? Never before had Julius seen that. Not even in groups of psychotic patients on the psychiatric ward. Surely, Julius thought, he had made a blunder inviting Philip into the group. Having to tell the group about his cancer was more than enough on his plate for the day, and he felt burdened by having to worry about Philip. What was going on with Philip? Was it possible that he was simply overcome by apprehension or shyness? Unlikely. No, he's probably pissed at my insisting on his entering a group, and in his passive-aggressive way, he's giving me and the group the finger. God, Julius thought. I'd just like to hang him out to dry. Just do nothing. Let him sink or swim. It would be a pleasure to sit back and enjoy the blistering group attack that will surely come. Julius did not often remember joke punchlines, but one that he had heard years ago returned to him now. One morning, a son said to his mother, "I don't want to go to school today." "Why not?" asked his mother. "2 reasons. I hate the students, and they hate me." Mother responds, "There are 2 reasons you have to go to school. First, you're 45 years old, and second, you're the principal." Yes, he was all grown up, and he was the therapist of the group. And it was his job to integrate new members, to protect them from others and from themselves, though he almost never started a meeting himself, preferring to encourage the members to take charge of running the group. Today he had no choice. 4:30, time to get started. Philip, why don't you grab a seat? Philip turned to face him but made no movement toward a chair. Is he deaf? Julius thought. A social imbecile? Only after Julius vigorously gestured with his eyeballs to one of the empty chairs did Philip seat himself. To Philip, he said, "Here's our group. There's one member who won't be here tonight. Pam, who's on a 2-month trip." Then turning to the group, "I mentioned a few meetings ago that I might be introducing a new member. I met with Philip last week, and he's beginning today." Of course he's beginning today, Julius thought. Stupid shithead comment. That's it. No more handholding. Sink or swim. Just at that moment, Stuart, rushing in from the pediatric clinic at the hospital and still wearing a white clinical coat, charged into the room and plunked himself down, muttering an apology for being late. All the members then turned to Philip, and four of them introduced themselves and welcomed him. "I'm Rebecca. Tony.
Bonnie.
Stuart, hello.
Great to see you. Welcome."
"Glad to have you. We need some new blood. I mean, new input." The remaining member, an attractive man with a prematurely bald pate flanked by a rim of light brown hair and the hefty body of a football linesman somewhat gone to seed, said in a surprisingly soft voice, "Hi, I'm Gil, and Philip, I hope you won't feel I'm ignoring you, but I absolutely urgently need some time in the group today. I've never needed the group as much as today." No response from Philip. "Okay, Philip?" Gil repeated. Startled, Philip opened his eyes widely and nodded. Gil turned toward the familiar faces in the group and began, "A lot has happened, and it all came to a head this morning following a session with my wife's shrink. I've been telling you guys over the past few weeks about how the therapist gave Rose a book about child abuse that convinces her she was abused as a child. It's like a fixed idea. What do you call it? An idea fixed?" Gil turned to Julius. "An idée fixe," Philip instantaneously interjected with perfect accent. "Right, thanks," said Gil. He shot a quick look at Philip and added, sotto voce, "Whoa, that was fast." And then returned to his narrative. "Well, Rose has an idée fixe that her father sexually molested her when she was young. She can't let it go. Does she remember any sexual event happening? No. Witnesses? No. But her therapist believes that if she's depressed, fearful about sex, has stuff like lapses in attention and uncontrollable emotions, especially rage at men, then she must have been molested. That's the message of that goddamn book. And her therapist swears by it. So for months, as I told you ad nauseum, we've been talking about little else. My wife's therapy is our life. No time for anything else, no other topic of conversation. Our sex life is defunct. Nothing. Forget it. A couple of weeks ago, she asked me to phone her father. She won't talk to him herself. And invite him to come to her therapy session. She wanted me to attend too. For protection, she said. So I phoned him. He agreed immediately. Yesterday he took a bus down from Portland and appeared at the therapy session this morning carrying his beat-up suitcase because he was going to head right back to the bus station after we met. The session was a disaster. Absolute mayhem. Rose just unloaded on him and kept on unloading, without limits, without let-up, without a word of acknowledgement that her old man had come several hundred miles for her. For her 90-minute therapy session, accusing him of everything, even of inviting his neighbors, his poker chums, his co-workers at the fire department. He was a fireman back then, to have sex with her when she was a child.
What did the father do?
Asked Rebecca. A tall, slender, 40-year-old woman of exceptional beauty who had been leaning forward, listening intently to Gil. He behaved like a mensch. He's a nice old man, about 70 years old, kindly, sweet. This is the first time I met him. He was amazing. God, I wish I had a father like that. Just sat there and took it and told Rose that if she had all that anger, it was probably best to let it out. He just kept gently denying all her crazy charges and took a guess, a good one, I think, that what she is really angry about is his walking out on the family when she was 12. He said her anger was fertilized, his word, he's a farmer, by her mother, who had been poisoning her mind against him since she was a child. He told her he had had to leave, that he had been depressed out of his gourd living with her mother, and would be dead now if he had stayed. And let me tell you, I know Rose's mother, and he's got a point. A good one. So at the end of the session, he asked for a ride to the bus terminal, and before I could answer, Rose said she wouldn't feel safe in the same car with him. Got it, he said, and walked away, lugging his suitcase. Well, 10 minutes later, Rose and I are driving down Market Street, and I see him. A white-haired, stooped old man pulling his suitcase. It was starting to rain, and I say to myself, this is the shits. I lost it and told Rose, he comes here for you, for your therapy session. He comes all the way from Portland. It's raining, and goddammit, I'm taking him to the bus station. I pulled over to the curb and offered him a lift. Rose stares daggers at me. If he gets in, I get out, she says. I say, be my guest. I point to the Starbucks in the street and tell her to wait there and I'll come back in a few minutes. She gets out and stalks off. That was about 5 hours ago. She never did show up at Starbucks. I drove over to Golden Gate Park and been walking around since. I'm thinking of never going home. With that, Gil flopped back in his chair, exhausted. The members, Tony, Rebecca, Bonnie, and Stuart, broke out into a chorus of approval.
Great, Gil. About time, Gil.
Wow, you really did it.
Whoa, good move, Tony said. I can't tell you how glad I am that you tore yourself loose from that bitch.
If you need a bed,
said Bonnie, nervously running her hands through her frizzy brown hair and adjusting her goggle-shaped yellow-tinted spectacles.
I've got a spare room. Don't worry, you're safe, she added with a giggle. I'm too old for you and my daughter's home.
Julius, not happy with the pressure the group was applying. He had seen too many members drop out of too many therapy groups because they were ashamed of disappointing the group, made his first intervention. Strong feedback you're getting, Gil. How do you feel about it?
Great. It feels great. Only I don't want to disappoint everybody. This is happening so fast. This all just happened this morning. I'm shaky and I'm fluid. Don't know what I'm gonna do.
You mean, said Julius, you don't want to substitute your wife's imperatives with the group's imperatives?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, I see what you mean, right. But it's a mixed bag. I really want, really, really need this encouragement. Grateful for it. I need guidance. This may be a turning point in my life. Heard from everyone but you, Julius, and of course from our new member. Philip, is it?
Philip nodded.
Philip, I know you don't know about my situation, but you do.
Gil turned to face Julius.
What about it? What do you think I should do?
Julius involuntarily flinched and hoped it had not been visible. Like most therapists, he hated that question. The damned if you do, damned if you don't question. He had seen it coming.
Gil, you're not going to like my answer. but here it is. I can't tell you what to do. That's your job, your decision, not mine. One reason you're here in this group is to learn to trust your own judgment. Another reason is that everything I know about Rose and your marriage has come to me through you. And you can avoid giving me biased information. What I can do is help you focus on how you contribute to your life predicament. We can't understand or change Rose. It's you, your feelings, your behavior. That's what counts here, because that's what you can change. The group fell silent. Julius was right. Gil did not like that answer. Neither did the other members. Rebecca, who had taken out two barrettes and was flouncing her long black hair before replacing them, broke the silence by turning to Philip. You're new here and don't know the backstory that the rest of us know. But sometimes from the mouth of newborn babes... Philip sat silent. It was unclear whether he had even heard Rebecca. Yeah, you have a take on this, Philip? Said Tony in what was, for him, an unusually gentle tone. Tony was a swarthy man with deep acne scars on his cheeks, and a lean, graceful athletic body exhibited to good advantage in his black San Francisco Giants t-shirt and tight jeans. I have an observation and a piece of advice, said Philip, hands folded, head tilted back, and eyes fixed on the ceiling. Nietzsche once wrote that a major difference between man and the cow was that the cow knew how to exist, how to live without angst, that is, fear, in the blessed now, unburdened by the past and unaware of the terrors of the future. But we unfortunate humans are so haunted by the past and future that we can only saunter briefly in the now. Do you know why we yearn for the golden days of childhood? Nietzsche tells us it's because those childhood days were the carefree days, days free of care, days before we were weighted down by leaden, painful memories, by the debris of the past. Allow me to make one marginal note. I refer to a Nietzsche essay, but this thought was not original. In this, as in so much else, he looted the works of Schopenhauer. He paused. A loud silence rang out in the group. Julius squirmed in his chair, thinking, Oh, shit. I must have been out of my fucking mind to bring this guy here. This is the goddamnest most bizarre way I've ever seen a patient come into a group. Bonnie broke the silence. Turning her gaze squarely upon him, she said,
That's fascinating, Philip. I know I keep yearning for my childhood, but I never understood it that way. That childhood feels free and golden because there's no past to weigh you down. Thanks. I'm going to remember that.
Me too. Interesting stuff, said Gil. But you said you had advice for me?
Yes. Here's my advice.
Philip spoke evenly, softly, still making no eye contact. Your wife is one of those people who is particularly unable to live in the present because she is so heavily laden with the freight of the past. She is a sinking ship. She's going down. My advice to you is to jump overboard and start swimming. She'll produce a powerful wake when she goes under. So I urge you to swim away as fast and as hard as you can. Silence. The group seems stunned.
Hey, no one is going to accuse you, said Gil, of pulling your punches. I asked a question. You gave an answer. I appreciate that. A lot. Welcome to the group. Any other comments you got? I want to hear them.
Well, said Philip, still looking upward. In that case, let me add one additional thought.
Kierkegaard describes some individuals as being in double despair, that is, they are in despair, but too self-deceived to know even that they are in despair. I think you may be in double despair. Here's what I mean. Most of my own suffering is a result of my being driven by desires, and then, once I satisfy a desire, I enjoy a moment of satiation, which is soon transformed into boredom, which is then interrupted by another desire springing up. Schopenhauer felt this was the universal human condition. Wanting, momentary satiation, boredom, further wanting. Back to you. I question whether you've yet explored this cycle of endless desires within yourself. Perhaps you have been so preoccupied with your wife's wishes it's kept you from becoming acquainted with your own desires. Isn't that why others here were applauding you today? Wasn't it because you were finally refusing to be defined by her wishes? In other words, I'm asking whether your work on yourself has been delayed or derailed by your preoccupation with your wife's wishes. Gil listened, mouth gaping. Gaze fixed on Philip. That's deep. I know there's something deep and important in what you're saying, in this double despair idea, but I'm not getting it all. All eyes were now on Philip, who continued to have eyes only for the ceiling. Philip, said Rebecca, now finished with replacing her barrettes. Weren't you saying that Gil's personal work won't really begin until he liberates himself from his wife? Or, Tony said, that his involvement with her prevents him from knowing how fucked up he really is. Hell, I know this is true for me and the way I relate to my work. I've been thinking this past week that I'm so busy being ashamed of being a carpenter, being blue-collar, being low-income, being looked down on, that I never get around to thinking about the real shit I should be dealing with. Julius watched in amazement as others, thirsty for Philip's every word, chimed in. He felt competitive urges rising but quelled them by reminding himself that the group's purposes were being served. "Cool it, Julius," he said to himself. "The group needs you. They're not going to desert you for Philip. What's going on here is great. They are assimilating the new member. And they're also each laying out agendas for future work." He had planned to talk about his diagnosis in the group today. In a sense, his hand was now forced because he had already told Philip he had a melanoma, and, to avoid the impression of a special relationship with him, had to share it with the whole group. But he had been preempted. First, there was Gil's emergency. And then there was the group's total fascination with Philip. He checked the clock. 10 minutes left. Not enough time to lay this on them. Julius resolved that he would absolutely begin the next meeting with the bad news. He remained silent and let the clock run out. 12. The kings left their crowns and scepters behind here, and the heroes their weapons. Yet the great spirits among them all, whose splendor flowed out of themselves, who did not receive it from outward things, they take their greatness across with them. Arthur Schopenhauer, age 16 at Westminster Abbey. 1799. Arthur learns about choice and other worldly horrors. When the 9-year-old Arthur returned from Le Havre, his father placed him in a private school whose specific mandate was to educate future merchants. There he learned what good merchants of the time had to know: to calculate in different currencies, to write business letters in all the major European languages, to study transport routes, trade centers, yields of the soil, and other such fascinating topics. But Arthur was not fascinated. He had no interest in such knowledge, formed no close friendships at school, and dreaded more each day his father's plan for his future. a 7-year apprenticeship with a local business magnate. What did Arthur want? Not the life of a merchant. He loathed the very idea. He craved the life of a scholar. Though many of his classmates also disliked the thought of a long apprenticeship, Arthur's protest ran far deeper. Despite his parents' strong admonitions, a letter from his mother instructed him to put aside all these authors for a while. You are now 15 and have already read and studied the best German, French, and, in part, also English authors. He spent all his available free time studying literature and philosophy. Arthur's father, Heinrich, was tormented by his son's interests. The headmaster of Arthur's school had informed him that his son had a passion for philosophy, was exceptionally suited for the life of a scholar, and would do well to transfer to a gymnasium which would prepare him for the university. In his heart, Heinrich may have sensed the correctness of the schoolmaster's advice. His son's voracious consumption and comprehension of all works of philosophy, history, and literature in the extensive Schopenhauer library was readily apparent. What was Heinrich to do? At stake was his successor, as well as the future of the entire firm and his filial obligation to all his ancestors to maintain the Schopenhauer lineage. Moreover, he shuddered at the prospect of a male Schopenhauer subsisting on the limited income of a scholar. First, Heinrich considered setting up a lifelong annuity through his church for his son, but the cost was prohibitive. Business was bad, and Heinrich also had obligations to guarantee the financial future of a wife and daughter. Then gradually a solution, a somewhat diabolical solution, began to form in his mind. For some time he had resisted Johanna's pleas for a lengthy tour of Europe. These were difficult times. The international political climate was so unstable that the safety of the Hanseatic cities was threatened, and his constant attention to business was required. Yet because of weariness and his yearning to shed the weight of business responsibilities, his resistance to Johanna's request was wavering. Slowly there swiveled into mind an inspired plan that would serve two purposes. His wife would be pleased, and the dilemma of Arthur's future would be resolved. His decision was to offer his 15-year-old son a choice. "You must choose," he told him. "Either accompany your parents on a year's grand tour of all of Europe, or pursue a career as a scholar. Either you give me a pledge that on the day you return from the journey you will begin your business apprenticeship, or forego this journey, remain in Hamburg, and immediately transfer to a classical educational curriculum which will prepare you for the academic life." Imagine a 15-year-old facing such a life-altering decision. Perhaps the ever-pedantic Heinrich was offering existential instruction. Perhaps he was teaching his son that alternatives exclude, that for every yes, there must be a no. Indeed, years later, Arthur was to write, "He who would be everything cannot be anything." Or was Heinrich exposing his son to a foretaste of renunciation? That is, if Arthur could not renounce the pleasure of the journey, how could he expect himself to renounce worldly pleasures and live the impecunious life of a scholar? Perhaps we are being too charitable to Heinrich. Most likely his offer was disingenuous because he knew that Arthur would not, could not, refuse the trip. No 15-year-old could do that in 1803. At that time, such a journey was a priceless once-in-a-lifetime event, granted only to a privileged few. Before the days of photography, foreign places were known only through sketches, paintings, and published travel journals, a genre, incidentally, that Johanna Schopenhauer was later to exploit brilliantly. Did Arthur feel he was selling his soul? Was he tormented by his decision? Of these matters, history is silent. We only know that in 1803, at the age of 15, he set off with his father, mother, and a servant on a journey of 15 months throughout all of Western Europe and Great Britain. Adele, his 6-year-old sister, was deposited with a relative in Hamburg. Arthur recorded many impressions in his travel journals written, as his parents required, in the language of the country visited. His linguistic aptitude was prodigious. The 15-year-old Arthur was fluent in German, French, and English, and had working knowledge of Italian and Spanish. Ultimately, he was to master a dozen modern and ancient languages, and it was his habit, as visitors to his memorial library have noted, to write his marginal notes in the language of each text. Arthur's travel journals offer a subtle prefiguring of interests and traits, which were aggregating into a persistent character structure. A powerful subtext in the journals is his fascination with the horrors of humanity. In exquisite detail, Arthur describes such arresting sights as starving beggars in Westphalia, the masses running in panic from the impending war, the Napoleonic campaigns were incubating, thieves, pickpockets, and drunken crowds in London, marauding gangs in Poitiers, the public guillotine on display in Paris, the 6,000 galley slaves on view as in a zoo in Toulon, doomed to be chained together for life in landlocked naval hulks too decrepit to put out to sea ever again. And he described the fortress in Marseille, which once housed the man in the iron mask, and the Black Death Museum, where letters from quarantined sections of the city were once required to be dipped into vats of hot vinegar before being passed on. And in Lyon, he remarked on the sight of people walking indifferently over the very spot where their fathers and brothers were killed during the French Revolution. At a boarding school in Wimbledon, where Lord Nelson had once been a student in England, Arthur perfected his English and attended public executions and naval floggings, visited hospitals and asylums, and walked by himself through the massive teeming slums of London. The Buddha, as a young man, lived in his father's palace, where the common lot of mankind had been veiled from him. It was only when he first journeyed outside of his father's palace that he saw the three primal horrors of life: a diseased person, a decrepit old man, and a corpse. His discovery of the tragic and terrible nature of existence led the Buddha to his renunciation of the world and the search for a relief from universal suffering. For Arthur Schopenhauer, too, early views of suffering profoundly influenced his life and work. The similarity of his experience to that of the Buddha was not lost on him, and years later, when writing about his journey, he said, "In my 17th year, without any learned school education, I was gripped by the misery of life, just like Buddha in his youth, when he saw sickness, pain, aging, and death." Arthur never had a religious phase. He had no faith, but when young, he had a will to faith, a wish to escape the terror of a totally unobserved existence. Had he a belief in the existence of God, though, it would have been sorely tested by his teenage tour of the horrors of European civilization. At the age of 18, he wrote, "This world is supposed to have been made by a god? No, much better by a devil." 13. When, at the end of their lives, most men look back, they will find that they have lived throughout ad interim. They will be surprised to see that the very thing they allowed to slip by unappreciated and unenjoyed was just their life. And so a man, having been duped by hope, dances into the arms of death. The trouble with a kitten is that, eventually, it becomes a cat. The trouble with a kitten is that, eventually, it becomes a cat. Jerking his head to dislodge the annoying couplet from his mind,
Julius sat up in bed and opened his eyes. It was 6 a.m., a week later, the day of the next group meeting. And those odd Ogden Nash lines looping around in his mind had been the background music for yet another night of unsatisfying sleep. Though everyone agrees that life is one goddamn loss after another, few know that one of the most aggravating losses awaiting us in later decades is that of a good night's sleep. Julius knew that lesson all too well. His typical night consisted of tissue-thin dozing, which almost never entered the realm of deep, blessed delta-wave slumber. A sleep that was interrupted by so many awakenings that he often dreaded going to bed. Like most insomniacs, he awoke in the morning believing either that he had slept far fewer hours than he actually had, or that he had been awake all night long. Often he could assure himself that he had slept only by carefully reviewing his nocturnal thoughts, and realizing that he would never, in a waking state, have ruminated at such length about such bizarre, irrational things. But this particular morning, he was entirely confused about how much he had slept. The kitten-cat couplet must have emerged from the dream realm, but his other nocturnal thoughts fell into a no-man's land, with neither the clarity and purposefulness of a full-fledged consciousness, nor the quirky caprice of dream thoughts. Julius sat in bed, reviewing the couplet with his eyes closed. Following the instructions he offered patients to facilitate the recall of nighttime fantasies, hypnagogic images, and dreams. The poem was pointed at those who loved kittens, but not their coming to age as cats. But what did that have to do with him? He loved kittens and cats alike, had loved the two adult cats in his father's store, loved their kittens and their kittens' kittens, and couldn't understand why the couplet lodged in his mind in such tiresome fashion. On second thought, perhaps the verse was a grim reminder of how, all his life, he had embraced the wrong myth, namely that everything about Julius Hertzfeld, his fortune, stature, glory, was spiraling upward, and that life would always get better and better. Of course, now he realized that the reverse was true, that the couplet had it right, that the golden age came first, that his innocent kittenly beginnings, the playfulness, the hide-and-seek, the capture-the-flag games, the building of forts out of empty liquor boxes in his father's store, while unburdened by guilt, guile, knowledge, or duty, was the very best time of life. And that as the days and years passed, the intensity of his flame dimmed, and existence grew inexorably more grim. The very worst was saved for last. He recalled Philip's words about childhood in the last meeting. No doubt about it. Nietzsche and Schopenhauer had that part right. Julius nodded his head sadly. It was true he had never truly savored the moment, never grasped the present, never said to himself, this is it, this time, this day, this is what I want. These are the good old days right now. Let me remain in this moment. Let me take root in this place for all time. No. He had always believed that the juiciest meat of life was yet to be found, and had always coveted the future, the time of being older, smarter, bigger, richer. And then came the upheaval, the time of the great reversal, the sudden and cataclysmic de-idolization of the future, and the beginning of the aching yearning for what used to be. When was that reversal? When did nostalgia replace the golden promise of tomorrow? Not in college, where Julius considered everything as prelude and obstacle to the grand prize,
admission to medical school. Not in medical school, where in his first years he yearned to be out of the classrooms and onto the wards as a clinical clerk, with white jacket and stethoscope hanging out of a pocket, or slung casually around his neck like a steel and rubber shawl. Not in the clerkships of his third and fourth medical school years, when he finally took his place on the wards. There he yearned for more authority, to be important, to make vital clinical decisions, to save lives, to dress in blue scrubs and careen a patient on a gurney down the corridor to the OR to perform emergency trauma surgery. Not even when he became chief resident in psychiatry, peeked behind the curtain of shamanism, and was stunned at the limits and uncertainty of his chosen profession. Without doubt, Julius's chronic and persistent unwillingness to grasp the present had played havoc with his marriage. Though he had loved Miriam from the moment he laid eyes on her in the 10th grade, he simultaneously resented her as an obstacle blocking him from the multitude of women he felt entitled to enjoy. He had never completely acknowledged that his mate search was over, or that his freedom to follow his lust was in the slightest way curtailed. When his internship began, he found that the house staff sleeping quarters were immediately adjacent to the nursing school dorm, brimming with nubile young nurses who adored doctors. It was a veritable candy store, and he stuffed himself with a rainbow of flavors. It was only after Miriam's death that the reversal must have occurred. In the 10 years since the car crash took her from him, he had cherished her more than while she was alive. Julia sometimes heaved with despair when he thought of how his lush contentment with Miriam, the true idyllic soaring moments of life, had come and gone without him fully grasping them. Even now, after a decade, he could not speak her name quickly but had to pause after each syllable. He knew also that no other woman would ever really matter to him. Several women temporarily dispelled his loneliness, but it didn't take long for him and for them to realize they would never replace Miriam. More recently, his loneliness was attenuated by a large circle of male friends, several of whom belonged to his psychiatric support group, and by his 2 children. For the past few years, he had taken all his vacations en famille, with his 2 children and 5 grandchildren. But all these thoughts and reminiscences had only been nocturnal trailers and short subjects. The main feature of the night's meditation had been a rehearsal of the speech he would deliver to the therapy group later that afternoon. He had already gone public about his cancer to many of his friends and his individual therapy patients. Yet, curiously, he was painfully preoccupied with his coming out in the group. Julius thought it had something to do with his being in love with his therapy group. For 25 years he looked forward eagerly to every meeting. The group was more than a clump of people. It had a life of its own, an enduring personality. Though none of the original members, except of course he himself, was still in the group, it had a stable, persisting self, a core culture, in the jargon, a unique set of norms, unwritten rules, that seemed immortal. No one member could recite the group norms, but everyone could agree whether a certain piece of behavior was appropriate or inappropriate. The group demanded more energy than any other event of his week, and Julius had labored mightily to keep it afloat. A venerable mercy ship, it had transported a horde of tormented people into safer, happier harbors. How many? Well, since the average stay was between 2 and 3 years, Julius figured at least 100 passengers. From time to time, memories of departed members wafted through his mind, snippets of an interchange, a a fleeting visual image of a face or incident. Sad to think that these wisps of memory were all that remained of rich, vibrant times, of events bursting with so much life, meaning, and poignancy. Many years ago, Julius had experimented with videotaping the group and playing back some particularly problematic interchanges at the next meeting. These old tapes were in an archaic format no longer compatible with contemporary video playback equipment. Sometimes he fancied retrieving them from his basement storage room, having them converted, and bringing departed patients back to life again. But he never did. He couldn't bear exposing himself to proof of the illusory nature of life, how it was warehoused on shiny tape, and how quickly the present moment and every moment to come will fade into the nothingness of electromagnetic wavelets. Groups require time to develop stability and trust. Often a new group will spin off members who are unable, for reasons of either motivation or ability, to engage in the group task, that is, interacting with other members and analyzing that interaction. Then it may go through weeks of uneasy conflict as members jockey for position of power, centrality, and influence. But eventually, as trust develops, the healing atmosphere grows in strength. His colleague, Scott, had once likened a therapy group to a bridge built in battle. Many casualties, that is, dropouts, had to be taken during the early formative stage, but once the bridge was built, it conveyed many people, the remaining original members and all those who subsequently joined the group, to a better place. Julius had written professional articles about the various ways that therapy groups help patients, but he always had difficulty in finding the language to describe the truly crucial ingredient, the group's healing ambiance. In one article, he likened it to dermatological treatments of severe skin lesions, in which the patient was immersed into soothing oatmeal baths. One of the major side benefits of leading a group, a fact never stated in the professional literature, is that a potent therapy group often heals the therapists as well as the patients. Though Julius had often experienced personal relief after a meeting, he was never certain of the precise mechanism. Was it simply a result of forgetting himself for 90 minutes, or of the altruistic act of therapy, or of enjoying his own expertise, feeling proud of his abilities, and enjoying the high regard of others? All of the above? Julius gave up trying to be precise, and for the past few years accepted the folksy explanation of simply dipping into the healing waters of the group. Going public with his melanoma to his therapy group seemed a momentous act. It was one thing, he thought, to be open with family, friends, and all the other folks residing backstage, but quite another to unmask himself to his primary audience, to that select group for whom he had been healer, doctor, priest and shaman. It was an irreversible step, an admission that he was superannuated, a public confession that his life no longer spiraled upward toward a bigger, brighter future. Julius had been thinking a good bit of the missing member, Pam, now traveling and not due to return for a month. He regretted she would not be there today for his disclosure. For him, she was the key member of the group, always a comforting, healing presence for others, and for him as well. And he felt chagrined by the fact that the group had not been able to help with her extreme rage and obsessional thinking about her husband and an ex-lover, and that Pam, in desperation, had sought help at a Buddhist meditation retreat in India. And so, heaving and churning with all these feelings, Julius entered the group room at 4:30 that afternoon. The members were already seated, and poring over sheets of paper which were whisked out of sight when Julius entered. Odd, he thought. Was he late? He took a quick look at his watch. Nope, 4:30 on the dot.
He put it out of mind and began the recitation of his prepared statement.
Well, let's get started. As you know, I never make a practice.